Marcus Whitman. This is the forgotten story of the greatest ride. The history of the nation has been punctuated with other great rides, it is true. Paul Revere rode 30 miles to rouse the Middlesex Minutemen and save from capture the guns and powder stored at Concord. Sheridan rode the 20 miles from Winchester to Cedar Creek, and by his thunderous, "Turn, boys, turn, we're going back," saved the battle. And the names of them both are immortalized in verse that is more enduring than bronze. Whitman, the missionary, rode 4,000 miles and saved us an empire, and his name is not known at all. Though there were other actors in the great drama which culminated in the grim old preacher's memorable ride, suave, frock-coated diplomats and furtive secret agents and sun-bronzed, leather-shirted frontiersmen and bearded factors of the fur trade, the story rightfully begins and ends with Indians. There were four of them, all chieftains. They rode their lean and wiry ponies up the dusty, unpaved thoroughfare in St. Louis, known as Broadway, one afternoon in the late autumn of 1832. The news of their arrival being reported to General Clark, the military commandant, he promptly assumed the ciceronage of the bewildered but impassive red men. Having, as it chanced, been an Indian commissioner in his earlier years, he knew the tribe well and could speak with them in their own tongue. They came from the country known as Oregon. They had spent the entire summer and autumn upon their journey, but the Indians gave no explanation of the purpose of their visit. After some days had passed, however, they confided to General Clark that rumors had filtered through to their tribe of the white man's book of life, and that they had been sent to seek it. He treated the emissaries with the utmost hospitality, taking them to dances and such other entertainments as the limited resources of the St. Louis of those days afforded, and, being himself a devout Catholic, to his own church. Thus passed the winter, during which two of the chiefs died. In the spring, the two survivors made preparations for their departure, but before they left, General Clark, who had taken a great liking to these dignified and intelligent red men, insisted on giving them a farewell banquet. After the dinner, the elder of the chiefs was called upon for a speech. You must picture him as standing with folded arms, tall, straight, and of commanding presence, at the head of the long table, a most dramatic and impressive figure in his garments of quill-embroidered buckskin, with an eagle feather slanting in his hair. He spoke, and General Clark translated what he had said to the attentive audience of army officers, government officials, priests, merchants, and traders who lined the table. "I have come to you, my brothers," he began, "over the trail of many moons from out of the setting sun. You were the friends of my fathers who have all gone the long way. I have come with an eye partly open for my people who sit in darkness. I go back with both eyes closed. How can I go back blind to my blind people? I made my way to you with strong arms through many enemies and strange lands that I might carry much back to them. I go back with both arms broken and empty. Two fathers came with us. They were the braves of many winters and wars. We leave them asleep here by your great water and wigwams. They were tired in many moons, and their moccasins wore out. My people sent me to get the white man's book of life. You took me to where you allow your women to dance as we do not ours, and the book was not there. You took me to where they worship the Great Spirit with candles, and the book was not there. You showed me images of the good spirits and pictures of the good land beyond, but the book was not among them to tell us the way. I am going back the long and sad trail to my people in the dark land. You make my feet heavy with gifts, and my moccasins will grow old in carrying them, yet the book is not among them. When I tell my poor blind people, after one more snow, in the big council that I did not bring the book, no word will be spoken by our old men or by our young braves. One by one, they will rise up and go out in silence. My people will die in darkness, and they will go on a long path to other hunting grounds. No white man will go with them, and no white man's book to make the way plain. I have no more words." Just as the rude eloquence of the appeal touched the hearts of the frontier dwellers who sat about the table in St. Louis, so when it was translated and published in the Eastern papers, it touched the hearts and fired the imaginations of the nation. In a ringing editorial, the Christian Advocate asked, "Who will respond to go beyond the Rocky Mountains and carry the Book of Heaven?" And this was the cue for the missionary, whose name was Marcus Whitman, to set foot upon the boards of history. Very early he set his heart on entering the ministry, but owing to the dissuasions of his relatives and friends, who knew how pitifully meager was a clergyman's living in those days, he reluctantly abandoned the idea and took up instead the study of medicine. After practicing in Canada for several years, he returned to central New York, where, with but little help, he chopped a farm out of the wilderness, cleared it, and cultivated it, built a grist mill and a sawmill, and at the same time acted as physician for a district 50 miles in radius. He was in the heyday of life, prosperous and engaged to the prettiest girl in all the countryside, when, reading in the local paper the appeal made by the Indian chieftains in faraway St. Louis, the old crusading fervor that had first turned his thoughts toward the ministry flamed up clear and strong within him, and putting comfort, prosperity, everything behind him, he applied to the American Board for appointment as a missionary to Oregon. Such a request from a man so peculiarly qualified for a wilderness career as Whitman could not well be disregarded, and in due time he received an appointment to go to the banks of the Columbia, investigate, return, and report. The wish of his life had been granted, and in due time took his bride on the long and arduous trip across the continent. At this time, Oregon was a sort of no man's land, to which neither England nor the United States had laid definite claim, though the former, realizing the immensity of its natural resources and the enormous strategic value that would accrue from its possession, had long cast covetous eyes upon it. The Americans of that period, on the contrary, knew little about Oregon and cared less, regarding the proposals for its acquisition with the same distrust with which the Americans of today regard any suggestion for extending our boundaries below the Rio Grande. Daniel Webster had said on the floor of the United States Senate, "What do we want with this vast, worthless area, this region of savages and wild beasts, of shifting sands and whirlwinds of dust, of cactus and prairie dogs? To what use could we ever hope to put these great deserts or these endless mountain ranges, impenetrable and covered to their base with eternal snow? What can we ever hope to do with the western coast, a coast of 3,000 miles, rock-bound, cheerless, and uninviting, and not a harbor on it? Mr. President, I will never vote 1 cent from the public treasury to place the Pacific coast 1 inch nearer to Boston." The missionaries, recognizing the incalculable value of the country which the American government was deliberately throwing away, did everything in their power to encourage immigration. Their glowing accounts of the fertility of the soil, the balmy climate, the wealth of timber, the incalculable water power, the wealth in minerals, had each year induced a limited number of daring souls to make the perilous and costly journey across the plains. In the autumn of 1842, a much larger party than any that had hitherto attempted the journey, 120 in all, reached Wailapu. Among them was a highly educated and unusually well-informed man, General Amos Lovejoy. He was thoroughly posted in national affairs, and it was in the course of a conversation with him that Dr. Whitman first learned that the Webster-Ashburton Treaty would probably be ratified before the adjournment of Congress in the following March. It was generally believed that this treaty provided for the cession of the Oregon region to Great Britain in return for fishing rights off the coast of Newfoundland. Dr. Whitman instantly saw that, as a result of the incredible ignorance and short-sightedness of the statesmen, or rather the politicians who paraded as statesmen, at Washington, this great, rich territory was quietly slipping away from us without a protest. There was but one thing to do in such a crisis. He must set out for Washington. Though 4,000 miles of Indian-haunted wilderness lay between him and the white city on the Potomac, he did not hesitate. The winter was at hand, and the passes would be deep in snow and the plains destitute of pasturage. He did not falter. Though there was a rule of the American Board that no missionary could leave his post without obtaining permission from headquarters in Boston, Whitman shouldered all the responsibility. "I did not expatriate myself when I became a missionary," was his reply to some objection. "Even if the board dismisses me, I will do what I can to save Oregon to the nation. My life is of but little worth if I can keep this country for the American people." Whitman's friends in Oregon felt that he was starting on a ride into the valley of the shadow of death. They knew from their own experiences the terrible hardships of such a journey even in summer, when there was grass to feed the horses and men could live with comfort in the open air. It was resolved that he must not make the journey alone, and a call was made for a volunteer to accompany him, whereupon General Amos Lovejoy stepped forward and said quietly, "I will go with Dr. Whitman." On the morning of October 3, 1842, Whitman, saying goodbye to his wife and home, climbed into a saddle and, with General Lovejoy, their guide, and three pack mules, set out on the ride that was to win us an empire. The little group of American missionaries and settlers whom he left behind gave him a rousing cheer as he rode off, and then stood in silence, with choking throats and misted eyes, until the heroic doctor and his companions were swallowed by the forest. With horses fresh, they reached Fort Hall in 11 days. The journey from Fort Hall to Fort Uintah was one long nightmare, the temperature falling at times to 40 degrees below zero, and the snow being so deep in places that the horses could scarcely struggle through. While crossing the mountains on their way to Taos, they were caught in a blinding snowstorm, in which, with badly frozen limbs, they wandered aimlessly for hours. Finally, upon the guide admitting that he was lost and could go no farther, they sought refuge in a deep ravine. Whitman dismounted and, kneeling in the snow, prayed for guidance. Can't you picture the scene? The lonely, rock-walled gorge, the shivering animals standing dejectedly, heads to the ground and reins trailing. The general, muffled to the eyes in furs. In the center, upon his knees, the indomitable missionary, praying to the God of storms, and the snowflakes falling swiftly, silently, upon everything. As though in answer to the doctor's prayers, the lead mule, which had been left to himself, suddenly started plunging through the snowdrifts as though on an urgent errand, whereupon the guide called out, "This old mule'll find the way back to camp if he can live long enough to get there," and he did. The next morning the guide said flatly that he would go no farther. "I know this country," he declared, "and I know when things is possible and when they ain't. It ain't possible to get through, and it's plumb throwing your lives away to try it. I'm finished." This was a staggering blow for Whitman, for he was already 10 days behind his schedule. But he was far from being beaten. Telling Lovejoy to remain in camp and recuperate the animals, which he did by feeding them on brush in the inner bark of willows, for there was no other fodder, Whitman turned back to Fort Uncompahgre, where he succeeded in obtaining a stouter-hearted guide. In a week he had rejoined Lovejoy. The storm had ceased, and with rested animals they made good progress over the mountains to the pyramid pueblo of Taos, the home of Kit Carson. Tarrying there but a few hours, worn and weary though they were, they pressed on to the banks of the Red River, a stream which is dangerous even in summer, only to find a fringe of solid ice upon each shore with a rushing torrent 200 feet wide between. For some minutes the guide studied it in silence. "It's too dangerous to cross," he said at last decisively. "Dangerous or not, we must cross it, and at once," answered Whitman. Cutting a stout willow pole, 8 feet or so in length, he put it on his shoulder and remounted. "Now, boys," he ordered, "shove me off." Following the doctor's directions, Lovejoy and the guide urged the trembling beast onto the slippery ice and then gave him a sudden shove which sent him, much against his will, into the freezing water. Both horse and rider remained for a moment out of sight, then rose to the surface well toward the middle of the stream, the horse swimming desperately. As they reached the opposite bank, the doctor's ingenuity in proving himself with the pole quickly became apparent, for with it he broke the fringe of ice and thus enabled his exhausted horse to gain a footing and scramble ashore. Wood was plentiful, and he soon had a roaring fire. In a wild country, when one animal has gone ahead, the others will always follow. So the general and the guide had no great difficulty inducing their horses and pack mules to make the passage of the river, rejoining Whitman upon the opposite bank. Despite the fact that they found plenty of wood along the route they had taken, which was fully 1,000 miles longer than the northern course would have been, all the party were severely frozen, Whitman suffering excruciating pain from his frozen ears, hands, and feet. The many delays had not only caused the loss of precious time, but they had completely exhausted their provisions. A dog had accompanied the party, and they ate him. A mule came next, and that kept them until they reached Santa Fe, where there was plenty. From there, over the famous Santa Fe Trail to Bent's Fort, a fortified settlement on the Arkansas, was a long journey, but compared with what they had already gone through, an easy one. A long day's ride northeastward from this lonely outpost of American civilization, and they found across their path a tributary of the Arkansas. On the opposite shore was wood in plenty. On their side, there was none, and the river was frozen over with smooth, clear ice, scarce strong enough to hold a man. They must have wood, or they would perish from the cold. So Whitman, taking the axe, lay flat upon the ice and snaked himself across, cut a sufficient supply of fuel, and returned the way he went, pushing it before him. While he was cutting it, however, an unfortunate incident occurred. The axe helve was splintered. This made no particular difference at the moment, for the doctor wound the break in the handle with a thong of buckskin. But when they were in camp that night, a famished wolf, attracted by the smell of the fresh buckskin, carried off axe and all, and they could find no trace of it. Had it happened a few hundred miles back, it would have meant the failure of the expedition, if not the death of Whitman and his companions. On such apparently insignificant trifles do the fate of nations sometimes hang. Crossing the plains of what are now the states of Oklahoma and Kansas, great packs of gaunt, gray timber wolves surrounded their tent each night and were kept at bay only at the price of unceasing vigilance, one member of the party always remaining on guard with a loaded rifle. The moment a wolf was shot, its famished companions would pounce upon it and tear it to pieces. From Bent's Fort to St. Louis was, strangely enough, one of the most dangerous portions of the journey. Here they were in hourly danger from still more savage men, for in those days the Santa Fe Trail was frequented by bandits, horse thieves, renegade Indians, fugitives from justice, and the other desperate characters who haunted the outskirts of civilization and preyed upon the unprotected traveler. Notwithstanding these dangers, of which he had been repeatedly warned, the doctor, leaving Lovejoy and the guide to follow him with the pack animals, pushed on through this perilous region alone, but lost his way and spent 2 precious days in finding it again, a punishment, he said, for having traveled on the Sabbath. The only occasion throughout all his astounding journey when this man of iron threatened to collapse was when, upon reaching St. Louis in February 1843, he learned, in answer to his eager inquiries, that the Ashburton Treaty had been signed on August 9th, long before he left Oregon, and that it had been ratified by the Senate on November 10th, while he was floundering in the mountain snows near Fort Uncompahgre. For a moment, the missionary's mahogany-tanned face went white, and his legs threatened to give way beneath him. Could it be that this was the end of his dream of national expansion? Was it possible that his heroic ride had been made for naught? But summoning up his courage, he managed to ask, "Is the question of the Oregon boundary still open?" When he learned that the treaty had only settled the question of a few square miles in Maine, and that the matter of the northwest boundary was still pending, the revulsion was so great that he reeled and nearly fell. God be praised! There was still time for him to get to Washington. The river was frozen, and he had to depend upon the stage, and an overland journey from St. Louis to Washington in midwinter was no light matter. But to Whitman, with muscles like steel springs, 1,000 miles by stagecoach over atrocious roads was not an obstacle worthy of discussion. He arrived at Washington on the 3rd of March, just 5 months from the Columbia to the Potomac, in the same rough garments he had worn upon his ride, for he had neither time nor opportunity to get others. Soiled and greasy buckskin breeches, sheepskin chaparros, fleece side out, boot moccasins of elk skin, a cap of raccoon fur with a tail hanging down behind, frontier fashion, and a buffalo greatcoat with a hood for stormy weather, composed a costume that did not show 1 inch of woven fabric. His storm-tanned face carried all the iron-gray whiskers that 5 months' absence from a razor could put upon it. I doubt, indeed, if the shop windows of the National Capitol have ever reflected a more picturesque or striking figure. But he had no time to take note of the sensation which his appearance created in the streets of Washington. Would he be granted an audience with the president? Would he be believed? Would his mission prove successful? Those were the questions that tormented him. Those were days when the chief executive of the nation was hedged by less formality than he is in these busier times, and President Tyler promptly received him. Some day, perhaps, the people of one of those great states formed from the territory which he saved to the Union will commission a famous artist to point a picture of that historic meeting. The president, his keen, attentive face framed by the flaring collar and high black stock of the period, sitting low in his armchair. The great secretary of state, his mane brushed back from his tremendous forehead, seated beside him. And standing before them, the preacher pioneer, bearded to the eyes with frozen limbs, in his worn and torn garments of fur and leather, pleading for Oregon. He painted in glowing words the limitless resources, the enormous wealth in minerals and timber and water power of this land beyond the Rockies. He told his hearers, spellbound now by the interest and vividness of the narrative, of the incredible fertility of the virgin soil in which anything would grow, of the vastness of the forests, of the countless leagues of navigable rivers, of the healthful and delightful climate, of the splendid harbors along the coast, the last, but by no means least, of those hardy pioneers who had gone forth to settle this rich new region at peril of their lives and who, through him, were pleading to be placed under the shadow of their own flag. But Daniel Webster still clung obstinately to his belief that Oregon was a wilderness not worth the having. "It is impossible to build a wagon road over the mountains," he asserted positively. "My friend Sir George Simpson, the British minister, has told me so." "There is a wagon road over the mountains, Mr. Secretary," retorted Whitman, "for I have made it." It was the rattletrap old prairie schooner that the missionary had dragged into Oregon on two wheels in the face of British opposition that clinched and copper-riveted the business. It knocked all the argument out of the famous secretary, who, for almost the first time in his life, found himself at a loss for an answer. Here was a man of a type quite different from any that Webster had encountered in all his political experience. He had no axe to grind. He asked for nothing. He wanted no money, or office, or lands, or anything except that which would add to the glory of the flag, the prosperity of the people, the wealth of the nation. It was a powerful appeal to the heart of President Tyler. "What you have told us has interested me deeply, Dr. Whitman," said the president at length. "Now, tell me exactly what it is that you wish me to do." "If it is true, Mr. President," replied Whitman, "that, as Secretary Webster himself has said, the ownership of Oregon is very likely to follow the greater settlement and the larger amount of population, then all I ask is that you won't barter away Oregon or permit of British interference until I can organize a company of settlers and lead them across the plains to colonize the country. And this I will try to do at once." "Your credentials as a missionary vouch for your character, Dr. Whitman," replied the president. "Your extraordinary ride and your frost-bitten limbs vouch for your patriotism. The request you make is a reasonable one. I am glad to grant it." "That is all I ask," said Whitman, rising. The object that had started him on his 4,000-mile journey having been attained, Whitman wasted no time in resting. His work was still unfinished. It was up to him to get his settlers into Oregon, for the increasing arrogance of the Hudson's Bay Company confirmed him in his belief that the sole hope of saving the Valley of the Columbia lay in a prompt and overwhelming American immigration. He had, indeed, arrived at Washington in the very nick of time, for if prior to his arrival the British government had renewed its offer of compromising by taking as the international boundary the 49th parallel to the Columbia and thence down that river to the Pacific, thus giving the greater part of the present state of Washington to England, there is but little doubt that the offer would have been accepted. But the promise made by President Tyler to Whitman committed him against taking any action. Meanwhile, General Lovejoy had been busy upon the frontier, spreading the news that early in the spring, Dr. Whitman and himself would guide a body of settlers across the Rockies to Oregon. The news spread up and down the border like fire in dry grass. The start was to be made from Weston, not far from where Kansas City now stands, and soon the emigrants came pouring in, men who had fought the Indians in the wilderness all the way from the Great Lakes to the Gulf, men who had followed Boone and Bowie and Carson and Davy Crockett, a hardy, sturdy, tenacious breed who were quite ready to fight, if need be, to hold this northwestern land where they had determined to build their homes. The grass was late that spring of 1843, and the expedition did not get underway until the last week in June. Whitman, like a modern Moses, urged them forward. On pushed the winding train of white-topped wagons, crossing the sun-baked prairies, climbing the Rockies, fording the intervening rivers, creeping along the edge of perilous precipices, until at last they stood upon the summit of the westernmost range, with the promised land lying spread below them. Whitman, the man to whom it was all due, reined in his horse and watched the procession of wagons, bearing upward of 1,000 men, women, and children, make its slow progress down the mountains. He must have been very happy, for he had added the great, rich empire which the term Oregon implied to the Union. For 4 more years, Dr. Whitman continued his work of caring for the souls and the bodies of red men and white alike at the mission station of Wailapu. On August 6, 1846, as a direct result of his great ride, was signed the treaty whereby England surrendered her claims to Oregon. In those days, news traveled slowly along the frontier, and it was the following spring before the British outposts along the Columbia learned that the British minister at Washington had been beaten by the diplomacy of a Yankee missionary, and that the great despotic company, which for well nigh 2 centuries had been in undisputed control of this region, and which had come to regard it as inalienably its own, would have to move on. From that moment, Marcus Whitman was a doomed man, for it was a long-standing boast of the company that no man defied it and lived. The end came with dramatic suddenness. Early in the afternoon of November 20th, 1847, Dr. Whitman was sitting in the mission station prescribing medicine, as was his custom, for those of his Indians who were ailing when a blanketed warrior stole up behind him on silent moccasins and buried a hatchet in his head. Then hell broke loose. Whooping fiends in paint and feathers appeared as from the pit. Mrs. Whitman was butchered as she knelt by her dying husband. 14 other missionaries were murdered by the redskin monsters, and 40 women and children were carried into a captivity that was worse than death. And this by the Indians who, just 15 years before, had pleaded to have sent them the white man's book of heaven. Though no conclusive proof has ever been produced that they were whooped on to their atrocious deed by emissaries of the great monopoly which had been forced out of Oregon as a result of Whitman's ride, there is but little doubt that it instigated the massacre. Whitman had snatched an empire from its greedy fingers, and he had to pay the price. Though Marcus Whitman added to the national domain a territory larger and possessing greater natural resources than the German Empire, though but for him Portland and Tacoma and Seattle and Spokane would be British instead of American, no memorial of him can be found in their parks of public buildings. Instead of honoring the man who discovered the streams and forest from which they are growing rich, who won for them the very lands on which they dwell, unworthy discussions and debates as to the motives which animated him are the only tributes which have been paid him by the people for whom he did so much. But he sleeps peacefully on beside the mighty river, oblivious to the pettiness and ingratitude of it all. When history grants Marcus Whitman the tardy justice of perspective, over that lonely grave, a monument worthy of a nation builder shall rise.